London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it? The other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello, and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesemiddel. I'm your host. On today's program, 2006 is going to be a big year for telecommunications, internet, and media. The Congress is looking at a wholesale revision of the rules, policies, and regulations that govern these things. We need to know what's going on. So I called Ben Scott. He's policy director at Free Press, a media reform advocacy group. And he's going to fill us in on what's going on in those hallowed halls of Washington, D.C. And of course, in just a moment, I'll catch you up with what else is going on in our media environment with some Media Geek headline news. You'll want to stay tuned. And the FCC is getting closer to having a full set of commissioners for the first time since former Chairman Michael Powell stepped down in March of last year. On February 3rd, the White House announced that it has chosen a telecommunications lobbyist, Robert McDowell, to fill the seat vacated by Kathleen Abernathy at the end of 2005. Apparently, the Bush administration has largely delegated the job of choosing the next FCC commissioner to Senator Stevens, who told reporters a week earlier that he'd picked McDowell for this post. McDowell is senior vice president and assistant general counsel with CompTel, an industry association that represents the smaller telephone companies that compete with the large regional bells like Verizon, Bell South, and AT&T. The choice of McDowell is raising eyebrows with the big bells, who have a very ambitious deregulatory agenda set for 2006 as they enter the cable television arena and endeavor to get government approval to exert greater control over their internet lines. However, analysts believe that the bells will go lightly with their criticism of McDowell in order to stay in good graces with Stevens. McDowell's firm, CompTel, is headed by Stevens' top former aide, Earl Comstock. If McDowell is confirmed, his lobbying career could lay some speed bumps when the FCC considers telecommunications issues. He might be asked to recuse himself from issues involving former clients or matters on which he has submitted comments to the FCC. McDowell worked on the 2000 Bush presidential campaign, as did the FCC chairman. He ran unsuccessfully for the Virginia state legislature in 2003. If he joins the FCC, the commission will have 3 Republicans to 2 Democrats, which is normal for Republican administration. A full commission would make it easier for FCC Chairman Kevin Martin to move forward on controversial issues because he would be less likely to be stymied by a partisan divide. Up to now, he's had to delay addressing issues where the commission's 2 Democrats would present a strong challenge to his plans because they cannot be outvoted. A couple of weeks ago, I reported that Howard Stern, one of the fiercest critics of the FCC in the mass media, was appealing to the commission to help with pirate stations in New York and New Jersey that were rebroadcasting his new Sirius satellite radio-only program. In actuality, it was Stern's bosses at Sirius who were filing the complaints, since their contract with Stern is worth $500 million. Indications are that the most prominent pirate stations have shut down their broadcasts, but it looks like Howard is having a bigger problem with the internet. Sirius has gone after 2 sites, HearHoward100.com and HearHoward.org, that were streaming the program online. The 2 sites voluntarily shut down when contacted by Sirius. But peer-to-peer services are where it's relatively easy to find daily downloads of Stern's show, and they're a lot harder to shut down than streaming websites. While the suits at Sirius are upset about the leaks in the system, Stern seems more bemused than anything else, discussing on his show the renegade spirit of some of his most rabid fans. He probably realizes that he doesn't want to spark a backlash by excoriating the small number of listeners getting the show for free when he's already a very rich man. And a New York-based electronics kit manufacturer was recently fined $25,000 by the FCC for selling FM transmitter kits. According to the FCC, the kits sold by Ramsey Electronics operate with too much power to be used without a license on the U.S. airwaves. Further, transmitters for licensed use in the U.S. have to be inspected by the FCC, and Ramsey's transmitters have received no such approval. Ramsey has been known for years in radio hobbyist circles for its line of so-called Part 15 microtransmitters. Part 15 refers to a section of the FCC rules that govern the operation of very low-power unlicensed transmitters. Part 15 covers the types of small transmitters that can be used to broadcast portable music players on car radios and similar devices. Since the early 1990s, Ramsey's Part 15 transmitters have been many broadcasters' first point of entry into the world of unlicensed micropower broadcasting. In the late 1990s, Ramsey began offering higher power transmitters that output as much as 1 watt of power on the FM band. By comparison, the company's legal Part 15 transmitters output no more than 10 to 25 milliwatts of power. Ramsey attempted to get around the FCC's restrictions on transmitter power by labeling their high-power transmitters for export only. But according to the FCC's Notice of Apparent Liability, Ramsey did not actually restrict sales of their high-powered transmitters, but rather simply required customers to send a signed statement that they would not operate them in a manner not in accordance with the law. The FCC actually reduced Ramsey's fine because the company otherwise has a record of compliance with the commission with regard to the amateur radio equipment it manufactures and sells. What's somewhat surprising about this fine is that Ramsey has been offering their high-power transmitters for more than 6 years, advertising them plainly on their website and in their print catalog. According to John Anderson at DIYmedia.net, the FCC has been stepping up enforcement against unlicensed radio broadcasters as of late, so perhaps the Ramsey fine is a component of this effort. On January 20th, the FCC's top enforcement official spoke at the commission's monthly meeting, reporting that the commission, quote, investigated more than 200 complaints regarding unauthorized pirate radio broadcasts, end quote, in 2005. John says that the figure may be slightly inflated, but is roughly accurate. He notes, however, that the figure refers to investigations, which doesn't necessarily mean there was many actions or that there were 200 stations actually busted. And that's some of what's going on in our media environment. You are listening to Media Geek. Check it out online, MediaGeek.net. There's the Media Geek blog with news and views that I don't have time for on the show. It's updated all the time. Lots of interesting tidbits of information, so I do encourage you to check it out. You can also get the radio show online, radio.mediageek.net. You can download an MP3, an Ogg Vorbis, or you can subscribe to the podcast to get it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. It's all there, mediageek.net. Right now, the Congress is in the throes of assembling what is expected to be the Telecommunications Act of 2006. Most observers agree that the future of services like cable television and internet will be decided with the passage of this legislation. To help us know more about what is really going on in Washington, today I'm talking to Ben Scott. He's policy director at Free Press, which is a nonpartisan organization working to involve the public in media policymaking and to craft policies for more democratic media. So, Ben, can you tell us more about what's in store?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, to start out with, it's sort of a shorthand that reporters use to say that the Congress is debating the Telecommunications Act rewrite of 2006, which is a sort of 10 years later after the Telecommunications Act of 1996. But the reality is on Capitol Hill that the debate is taking place on all of the issues within that larger package. And the key issues are, number one, the franchising of cable television. And this issue comes to the head because the phone companies are about to get into the television business, and the regulatory model that was designed to cover just the incumbent cable operators is going to be changed to fit the new television that the telephone companies will be offering. So that's one issue, is cable franchising. Second major issue is interconnection and sort of the bowels of the internet, how the companies that own the wires will be required to deal with one another as they pass data back and forth, whether it's voice, video, or internet-related data. A third major issue is what's known as network neutrality, which is sounds like a wonky term, but perhaps the most important political debate over the future of the internet that we'll see. Net neutrality simply means that the owner of the network can't decide what happens on the network, that they have to run a totally non-discriminatory platform. And for those of you who are wondering, what the heck does that mean? That means exactly like the internet is today and how it's always been. If we lose net neutrality, it means that the phone companies and the cable companies that own the network will become the rulers of the network, and they will be able to, if they choose to, gatekeep and determine what content can be on the internet, how fast you can download this website versus that website, who can provide this service, who can provide that service. So that obviously is a major issue. Another issue on the table is whether or not localities like Champaign-Urbana will be allowed to offer their own broadband systems to their own citizens. You know, currently there are battle lines drawn amongst those who believe that cities should not be involved in broadband and others who believe that they're an essential part of bringing affordable broadband service to the American public.
Why are some of these issues coming up now? Cable franchising has been settled for 20-some years, and the public has had internet access for more than 10 years. Why are these things coming to the fore at this moment?
I think it's driven by technological convergence. In 1996, when they passed the original Telecommunications Act, it was the product of 5 years of legislative wrangling that had begun in the early 90s. And at that point, no one really understood what the internet was going to do and how big it was going to get. And so they created a regulatory structure that essentially regulated communication services by category. So you had one regulatory category that handled video or cable TV. You had one regulatory category that handled broadcasting, radio and television. You had one regulatory category that handled telephone service. And you had another regulatory category that handled pretty much everything else, which at that time they were loosely understood to be internet-related services. Now, as the cable companies diversify and bring you what's called a triple play, which means simply cable TV, telephone service, and internet service all along the same wire, and the phone companies are going to do the same thing, those divisions between categories and regulatory frames no longer really work. So the Congress is going to go back to the well and figure out how do we either alter the old law to make it fit the new technologies, or how do we create a totally new regulatory category that will cover all three. So that's the main problem that they're looking to address, and that's the reason why they want to do it now.
So they want to address the convergence of all these services over the same wires, and yet there must be some different conceptions of what the rights of consumers and the network owners are.
For sure. I mean, it's not a surprising situation. I mean, what's happened is the cable companies and the phone companies have said, okay, you know, now that we're offering all of us the same services, we have a competitive marketplace now. There are two of us instead of just one. Although they totally ignore the idea that two players in the market doesn't exactly make competition. But their solution is, let's just get rid of all the regulations since there's now competition. The flip side of that coin is the public interest and consumer position, which says, look here, you know, two companies don't make competition. You're still using wires that are laid along public lands. There are still major social implications for the media system being controlled by two industries. We need to have good public policy to make sure that the democratic needs of the media system are still met. So that's sort of how it's shaping up.
So if we look at the first issue you brought up, cable franchises, what are the stakes?
Well, the stakes are huge because the phone companies are coming to the Congress and they're saying, look, we understand that cable has been negotiating agreements with every city in the country for 25 years, and that's been the way cable franchising works, but hey, we don't really want to do that, and we'd like you to eliminate cable franchising for us, or you know, put it at a national level so that we sign one agreement and then we've got everybody and we can go build wherever we want, however we want to do it. And the cable companies have come along and say, well, we'd really rather that they had to follow the same rules that we did, but if they don't have to follow the rules, then we shouldn't have to follow the rules either. So let's just use this opportunity to eliminate the cable franchising system altogether, which would be a total disaster for the public. I mean, if you eliminate the franchising system, you eliminate the rent that those companies pay for using public lands. You eliminate public access television. You would eliminate any ability of the polity to demand that the network be open, that we have, you know, diversity in the media. It would hand total power over the communication systems to the owners of the wires, which would be absolutely unprecedented in the history of American communications policy, and just and turn the basic premise of public accountability and universal service on its head.
What kind of reception are the cable companies and telephone companies like AT&T and Verizon getting on Capitol Hill with their push for national franchising or no franchising whatsoever?
Well, the phone companies have gotten a very warm reception from Congress on the idea of a national franchise. They've gotten that because they have an enormously powerful lobbying presence, and they are extremely generous campaign financing sources. And there is an economic argument that says, how do we need to have more competition in the video market. Giving the Bell companies the ability to have a national franchise will get them in the market quicker, will bring the benefits of competition to more people, and therefore everyone will end up better in the end. So the Bells are having an extremely warm reception on Capitol Hill. And that can be a dangerous sign, I think, if that idea of facilitating competition is translated into the destruction of public responsibilities.
Now, is this a partisan issue? Is it one side of the aisle which is more friendly than others?
Not really, which I think is a positive sign for us in the public interest community. Because if you think about it, where will I, if I'm the executive at AT&T who's deciding where to build out a new television system and bring competition to a market, where am I going to go? Well, I'm going to go to the most affluent communities I can find, to the places where people have the most disposable income to spend on my new service. By the time I get out into a rural area, who knows? It could be 10, 20 years. Rural areas are predominantly, of course, represented by Republican members of Congress. So the Republican members of Congress looking after their rural areas, and the Democrats looking after the urban poor and the notion of public responsibility, definitely have a joint interest in holding the line on a franchising system that is fair and equitable to everybody.
That's interesting. So you're finding that a congressperson's take on this issue has more to do with the needs of one's district than party affiliation.
That seems to be the way it's shaping out, although it's very early in the process at this point, and most members have not yet declared a position one way or another, and they're hesitant to talk about it because they don't want to anger either cable or the phone companies in an election year.
You're listening to Media Geek, a weekly look at grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. I'm your host, Paul Riesmandel. You can check out Media Geek online at www.mediageek.net. There you'll find the Media Geek blog, featuring frequently updated news and views about our media environment. You can also listen to the show online at radio.mediageek.net, or even subscribe to the podcast to get the program automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player every week. That's all at mediageek.net. And I'm talking with Ben Scott today, Policy Director for the media reform group, Free Press. The other big issue that is coming up is network neutrality, which you referred to earlier, and the Senate Commerce Committee will be holding a hearing on that topic on February 7th. What is the argument over network neutrality about? What are the big telephone companies fighting for?
Their primary argument is, we built the network, it costs us a lot of money, we should be able to do with it whatever we like. And we don't need any regulations to stop us from blocking a website or to stop us from slowing down a download because, you know, we're good guys and we wouldn't do it. Just trust us. That's literally what they're saying on Capitol Hill. And any consumer who's ever dealt with the cable companies and the phone companies, I think, will raise an eyebrow and shake their head vigorously they're asked just to trust those monopoly providers.
And aside from just the, I guess maybe the philosophy of them having control over their own networks, what else is in it for them to try and block certain content or to deliver, you know, some things at a slower speed?
Well, what they'd like to do is collect double rent. They'd like to charge you, Paul, for your DSL line, $30 a month, thanks. And then they'd like to go out and charge every service provider who wants to offer video on the Internet, a podcast on the Internet, a blog, a website, anything. Anybody who wants their service to go faster than a snail crawl will have to pay a fee to offer that service at a high speed. So the cable cable and phone companies will collect not only your monthly access charge, but they'll collect all kinds of charges from the service providers who you use on the Internet that are all currently free. Now then, that's a great deal for the phone companies, and it's a bad deal for the service providers for sure. But ultimately, it will be a bad deal for you as a consumer as well, because those service providers aren't just going to eat those costs. They're going to pay the fee to Verizon and AT&T and Comcast and Time Warner, and then they're going to pass those costs right along to you as a consumer. So ultimately, it's going to lead to an increase in costs for every consumer of Internet services in the country.
And what kind of reception is this getting on Capitol Hill?
At the moment, it's hard to say. I mean, you won't find anyone on Capitol Hill who says they don't support network neutrality. The devil is in the details of how they define it. Some just say, well, net neutrality just means you can't block somebody else's website. But how those companies decide who goes at what speed, that's their business. Other people take a much harder line and say, you know, the owners of the network should not have any ability to control speed, quality of service, or content on those networks. That ought to be completely open and competitive amongst every service provider on the Internet, as it always has been. So that debate, I think, is going to be worked out over the next couple of months. The Senate Commerce hearing that you referred to will be an important starting point for getting the issue out in the open.
And will most of this debate go on the floor of Congress? Will we be able to watch it on C-SPAN?
Not exactly. I suspect that 99.9% of the debate over net neutrality that determines the ultimate policy that will be thrust upon the American public will be discussed, debated, and decided behind closed doors.
And who's privy to these conversations, to these debates?
Members of Congress, their staff, and the industry lobbyists who have the most to gain and lose from the policy decision. And if we're lucky, folks like Free Press and Consumers Union, who will have lobbyists on the Hill hoping to get a seat at the table and make sure that there is a public voice represented. And our job is also to raise a ruckus and make sure that everybody across the country who's concerned about the future of the Internet knows what's going on Capitol Hill, reaches out, contacts their members of Congress on the Senate and the House side, both, and demands fairness and responsibility in public policy.
Will we see any bills actually get passed before these midterm elections in the fall?
That's a matter of some speculation in Washington, D.C. parlor games. My own view is that it is unlikely we'll see a major telecommunications bill pass out of the Congress between now and November of 2006. But that doesn't mean it won't happen, and it certainly doesn't mean that the terms of the debate won't be set in stone before then. So we can't just relax and start thinking about this in December.
And do you think that there will be more public awareness, more press coverage than there was back in 1996?
Gosh, I hope so. Since in 1996, only one television network bothered to cover the most important piece of telecommunications legislation in a generation, and they did so for about 2.5 minutes. If we don't have more media coverage of this issue, it will be a national scandal. There could hardly be a more important debate in terms of our social and economic inequality than how we'll treat the future of the Internet, and that brings us all of our information and media.
You mentioned that average folks can contact their congresspeople on these issues. Are there other things they can do so that they're not left out of the debate over our telecommunications future?
Well, I think there are a number of things. One, the most direct and easiest is just to pick up the phone and call your legislators and indicate that you support network neutrality, and so should they. Another is to talk to your friends and family and community members and organize to resist the possibility that the phone companies and the cable companies will be handed the keys to the kingdom. And this means supporting community radio. It means supporting independent media centers. It means getting involved with alternative community broadband networks like you have there in Champaign-Urbana. It really is an issue where the public can take responsibility into its own hands and decide its own future.
And Free Press can lend a hand?
Absolutely. We have a large number of websites on our pages that describe the issue and explain how it all happens and what you can do about it. That's at freepress.net.
Indeed, this really is a year to pay attention to what Congress is saying and doing about telecommunications and media issues, and to hold our representatives accountable.
Without a doubt.
Ben, thank you very much for taking time to speak with me.
Absolutely, Paul. Thank you.
And that was Ben Scotti, his policy director for the media reform organization, Free Press. And as he mentioned, you can find them online at www.freepress.net. And they do have a pretty good media newswire that's constantly updated with lots of news from throughout the internet press about things going on in our media and of importance to media, as well as they have lots of action centers so you can find out more about particular issues and find out how you can act on them. That's freepress.net. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm your host and producer, Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media, as well as our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views about our media. You can also download the program at radio.mediageek.net or subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's all at MediaGeek.net. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Lowow. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some segments are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. And Media Geek is heard on 9 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. Media Geek is free to air on your local community radio station, too. Just drop me a line at paul@mediageek.org. That email address is also good for any comments you want to send in about the program. Once again, that's paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.